Well, I feel like I've been thinking about this, Brandon, and I feel like you need to have the Normie podcast music stinger thing for our opening topic, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And as I've been formatting in my head, I want it to go like this, kind of copied after one of my on and off favorite podcast of Books Could Kill. But I think they do this on lots of podcasts where, you know, the host says hello to the other person and then they kind of ask them a question about the topic. And then it's like, pow, music. Right. Mm-hmm. Like whatever their music is. So I've been thinking about this opening topic, and it is, let me calm myself to get into the mood here. And I'm going to say, Brandon, this is the episode. We need to talk about European showers.
There you go. Well, I don't know. We need a stinger. It sounds like we could just every week we could just wind you up and you could do a little beatbox. That's yeah. The stinger. I love it.
Yeah, that's no problem. I can do that. I'll put that in my annual performance review for SDT Limited. You know, really, really, really developed new skills and areas in a format.
Well, more importantly, you could say you're playing two roles. You're both a host, a producer, and now a musical guest. We'll give you like a musical credit every week. So
it's true.
But more importantly, Cote, I think is this the way that this would guy be like, well, Cote, what have you learned about European showers? Maybe that's exactly. That's the way I should have come back to you.
Yeah, totally. Well, okay, now we can get back into the flow. We'll remove ourselves. That was the part of the podcast where you patch the producer in, and the producer like has some meta commentary.
That's right. There you go. That. Perfect.
Yeah. So there was some posting in our Slack channel, which I think, you know, I was walking back from a dog walk, and I was thinking, like, I hear all these things about how you should have like active WhatsApp groups of friends and people you talk with, and I always want to start one, but how do you do that? I don't know. I could go around to my friends and be like, hey, we should have a WhatsApp group where we talk about stuff. And they'd be like, uh-huh. But then I realized we have our software-defined talk Slack, where I interact with people and talk with them all the time. But if you want to be interested in that, you can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/Slack. But there was someone, I think our friend Brian Gracely is in Europe, or he's reminiscing through photos of having been in Europe.
You know, he's indeed in Europe. I can confirm.
And he took a picture of a hotel bathroom that was great for several reasons. One, it had this wonderful hexagonal tiling, which, you know, in my current hobbies would be great for just playing D&D in the shower. You can do a hex crawl, which is fun. Also, it had some nice coloring between green and cream. But he noted with his American eyes that there's only half of the shower is covered by a glass wall. So if you imagine this, and as we'll get into, our European friends don't have to imagine this, but you've got a shower that's kind of like a rectangle, and half of the rectangle is covered by glass, and the other half is not covered by glass, and that's a shower, right? And this is, as with all comments like this, it's a generalization, so it's like this is not universal, but this is not unexpected at all to encounter in Europe. In hotels, and even some residences. And, you know, I've been away almost 5.5 years now, and I was realizing I kind of forgotten about that. And I even notice it when I go back is the, I must have seen this, but I feel like in Europe, I have never seen a shower curtain. Like, it just does not exist. It's not part of the culture. Whereas when you go back to the States, like that's what you do. You have a shower curtain now,
or you have a shower door. Like there's like a full a door that opens into it. That seems to be the biggest.
Exactly.
Reason. Why is that the shower just allows for? I think for the American view is like there's like a missing part of the shower, and therefore there's going to be water everywhere. I think that's how Americans approach the showers in Europe.
I think that's totally right, and that's why you always have a shower curtain. And I feel like it's been so long since I became a functioning adult, but I feel like there's like a rite of passage for all Americans into adulthood where they finally have the shower that is a dedicated shower and not just a shower head in a bathtub. Mm-hmm. But the crowning achievement is that you have the shower with that glass door that closes. And we all know the noise, like you stand in the, you know, the Fortress of Solitude there. Mm-hmm. And like you close that door and it has that, I can't even replicate it, but it definitely has this very distinct sound. if you don't have, I mean, even if you do have the shower water, no, on.
It's, but if you know, you know, there's thousands of people like that little whoosh kind of sound, a little,
yeah,
like,
with a little bit of a clink at the, not a clink, kind of, but yeah.
No, I know. It's sort of, it's like you've made it right before you turn on the water. You've made it in life.
Yeah. You more than likely you have another, you have a master bathroom. And that
is sweet. If we shall say,
yes. Yeah. You might even have his and hers or them and theirs or hers and hers or his and his sinks, might also be an upgrade for you. But so what is the, I don't really have any insight into why, the European shower systems are this way. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff, there probably is no reason. I mean, my go-to thing in all sort of European choices is often like, you know, it's small over here. They've kind of figured out all the space. They've had a couple thousand years to kind of like populate it, if not more. So there's really very few empty space.
Maybe just the more pragmatic, maybe the part that, at least the American perspective that we don't understand, that maybe you can bridge the gap here, is when I both use it, like it does seem like, again, just maybe just the American way of using a shower. It's like, it seems like when you use a shower, the problem is it's like you end up getting like a lot of the bathroom wet. So maybe, is there a way, have Europeans sort of mastered this? Are they sort of like, do they, if you will, point the shower, the head down more? Are they using less water pressure?
Yeah.
Why does, or they, do they just sort of like, well, that's just how you use the bathroom. It just gets wet and, you know, it's all tile, right?
Yeah. So
it just,
yeah. Well, you know, we would definitely, we would definitely have to do a wider survey. I'm not really sure. But I feel like it's kind of what you were saying at the end, which is just like, I don't think it occurs to people. Like, and also I think, is this true? Well, this is true, but I guess it's less true with American shower setups or bathrooms, to use that word appropriately, on both sides of the Atlantic for our current discussion. But many European bathrooms, and I think hotel ones as well, like they're tiled up to like waist level at least, right? Usually. Right. So there is, and I know, you know, from talking with Charles's wife, Silva, who's Finnish, that the assumption of a lot of Finnish bathrooming is that to clean it, you just get out the sprayer and you spray the whole thing down.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, you have a sauna in there as well. And so it's kind of like built in that it's just like,
it's a wet area. The whole area is a wet area. That's the
expectation. Right.
Whereas Americans were sort of, maybe it's not true, but we live in the idea that we'll keep the bathtub or shower or separate, and the rest of the bathroom will generally be dry. So maybe that's maybe we need to ultimately just embrace the moisture here in the United States.
Yeah. And you know, now that I'm thinking of it, the rental house we lived in for the first 2 years we were here, they did have an enclosed shower, but that was a very newly renovated situation. So maybe slowly, as with everything else, maybe our American cultural imperialism has reached the shower, and
I think this is another thing that we're going to add to your future businesses. So we already have, you're going to be selling Stanley cups with Pebble ice and free refills on your water ice business. And I think as an addendum to that business, you're also going to be selling shower doors. These opportunities in Europe, as far as I can see, wide open. No one is taking advantage of them. So that'll be fantastic.
I think our slogan, we can work on this, but I think maybe it'll be something along the lines of like, you know, if you're washing your full ass, don't half ass it on the shower door.
I don't know exactly how that's going to translate to all the European languages, but I like it. I think it's good. It's a good start.
Yeah. Well, speaking of good starts, I think, you know, we're always interested around here as pertains to tech companies in particular, in this notion, and I should say I'm always fascinated with this, of the ongoing oscillating, if that's the right term, between high growth and, as I think we've joked recently, normal operating for companies. And, you know, to explain that joke a little bit, right? Like when you, at least when I, and I think when one looks at the coverage of tech companies, like the coverage is always like, oh my God, this company only grew 32% instead of 38% year over year. And I always feel like, you know, over here is like, you know, Office Depot, and they're like, and
when things are okay.
But of course, the reason is because people who invest in high growth companies are expecting a high rate of return. So they've I think this is a totally not a very good way for society to price shares, but whatever. So they price the share price at what they think it's going to be worth in, what, 3-5 years or something like that?
And how much? What's the story and how much will it grow? That's the theory behind the stock market, but go on.
Right. And so, but whatever, that's the way it works. But then what happens, and this is like the ongoing mystery in this area for me, is what happens is, you know, you can only have so much double digit growth before you reach infinity, I think, which is impossible. You get sort of like, Zeno's paradox of enterprise value or something. And like, so eventually it has to stop. And when it stops, it's like, per what we were saying earlier, the investors are just like, I explained, you know, that scene in Casablanca I'm about to reference. I was explaining that to someone the other day. It was a delight to find someone who'd never seen Casablanca. But so then the company slows down to normal rates, and the investors are like, I'm shocked that growth has dipped below double digits. And everyone acts as if like, I had no idea this would happen.
Right.
This is crazy. Who knows how stocks work?
It's an unforeseen circumstance. No one could have predicted. Yes. I love it.
And I think, so that's a little bit of the setup. And I think this time of year with layoffs going on and it was just, quarterly, some earnings for people and things like that. You know, it's a good time to check in on various companies that are kind of navigating these waters, various tech companies. And, you know, that's always annoying, but you got your Apples, your Googles, your Microsofts, all these sorts of people, AWS. So like, what do you think, when you look at some of these companies, what do you think maybe the top one is that's going through this transition? And who knows which direction it's going to go or where it's going to settle, but like, which one of these companies do you think is like really in this situation? They're in the limbo or the DMZ of accelerating growth.
Yeah, no, I think, this week, I think we'd start with Google, right? Because Google just recorded their earnings. And again, it's not that they didn't make tons of money, which they did. It's that they didn't make as much money. And this is the Google overall, because actually the cloud business did fairly well. So that's a place that we can start to kind of look at a little bit. And I think, one of the, analogies that gets used a lot in venture capital that I'm going to actually propose that we retire in favor of another idea is that this idea of like, there's like a wartime CEO and a peacetime CEO. And of course, I don't like those things because we're really not at war and there's really no violence in business. So I'm going to propose that we call this the status quo CEO versus the growth CEO. And what I think you find here is that different circumstances and when people take over kind of dictate what kind of CEO they are. And I think we could start with the Google CEO, Sundar, right? And, he was basically, asked to take over Google. And I'm going to put him in the idea that his circumstances was status quo. It was like, hey, Larry Page steps down. They're printing money. There's kind of no end to the value. But now after, many years of success of him, kind of running it, Alphabet is, if you will, the earnings, while they continue to make tons of money, as I said before, Wall Street is specifically kind of getting worried in the sense of like, is this advertising revenue, which I think accounts for something like 97% or 90%+ of their overall revenue, is it going to continue? And then this is where you start to hear, kind of questions around, should there be a management change, right? And this is where people will say something like, is Sundar, is he right? Is he, I'm going to use again my new phrase. It's like, hey, he's really a status quo CEO and he's been doing that. But is it time for us now to start to look at a growth CEO, right? As someone that's going to come in. And I've kind of put forward is what you kind of end up with is like, ultimately a growth CEO, it's not so much the person, although that gets talked a lot about, it's the circumstances that come in. So have the circumstances at Google reached the point where they are actually willing to, if you will, reevaluate some of their core beliefs. And I think that's the difference between the status quo CEO and the growth CEO. The growth CEO sort of comes in with a mandate like, yeah, everything that we've been doing, even though it's the story of why the company was massively successful, we're going to put everything on the table. We're going to, if you will, we're going to absolutely look at everything that we do, and we're going to challenge the things we've done before. At least that's, they're going to be their mandate. Now we can talk about whether or not they succeed. But they're sort of given that idea. And I think we can kind of contrast the Google situation a little bit with Microsoft, which again, had strong earnings. And in fact, the story there is they slightly beat earnings, right? And so in this case, I think it's a different situation. I think the Microsoft CDO, came in at a point replacing Ballmer. And I think he was tasked with growing, right? And I think if we look at what they're, and I think if we kind of get very tangible, it's sort of like the Microsoft CEO has been willing, if you will, to make significant moves in AI that I think the Google CEO felt like they couldn't make, right? You know, invest in open AI, be very aggressive, right? Because there's sort of a mantra of like, Microsoft needs to grow. Like think about, you know, Windows is in the background, Nokia, remember they bought that a long time ago. All those decisions are in the background. And, you know, Satya Nadella is really kind of tasked with like, hey, what do you need to do? You need to go spend a lot of money on OpenAI? Do it. Whereas Google, status quo, right? Very, very slow to introduce even new functionality. So I think those are sort of like the competing things. So I don't know, could they like your thoughts on like, do you like that framing of the of it? And do you think, you know, is it more about the person? Like, so if we kind of say, is it Sundar? You know, is it like he needs to change, or is it just sort of like circumstances have changed? And oftentimes the easiest thing to do is to change the person rather than address the circumstances. What are your thoughts?
I think all of that stuff is great. Now, you know, to preview a recommendation, I think when we get to your recommendation at the end, we could have a lot of conversation about context and luck and things like that. But I think, you know, my only note, if you will, on what you said is the phrase status quo, because what I like with your rephrasing is there's a utility to it that the phrase become the like with growth, it becomes descriptive in a way that is almost it's almost deflating the lore around it. It's just like, ah, this is a growth company. That's what they're focused on. So they operate this way. Whereas I feel like, I don't know, in the Roman times, if status quo had this connotation. But nowadays, status quo basically means like, and it's that's why it's a good choice, but it means it has more of a negative connotation, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
And so like, and this, what I'm about to say is not accurate, but I feel like if I had ChatGPT open, I'd ask it. But I feel like I want a word like profit, because what you're doing in that situation is you're not worrying about crazy growth, you're worried about actual money making, right? So a growth company could be profitless, as Amazon was,
right?
And so like somehow the status quo or the peacetime, it's indicative of just like, let's just focus on running the business. But you know, until something happens, I think status quo is good, because the other reason it's good is it really does, it very clearly emphasizes what you were saying. You just have to like know that that's not negative. However, you could say, well, I don't know. You could say that that's, you know, I always love things that are like Rorschach tests, right? That depending on how people react to it also gives you additional information about their viewpoint. So anyone who, you know, responded to status quo as a negative thing, you could be like, oof, you seem like a handful, right? Like, this, I don't have time for that. You probably have multiple to-do lists and get a lot of shit done in your life. So like, that's a bummer.
But I like, you but know, where you're going there, I think it makes sense. And maybe you're right, because I didn't mean it to be negative. But like maybe another way to say the same thing in a more, you know, more positive light is sort of like, I think of status quo as sort of like indicating that like your strategy is solid, your business model is sound, right? And so we don't have major problems there. Our major question is like, can you keep the, you know, if you will, the trains running on time, right? So it's sort of like,
yes.
And that's not always, that's not an easy task, but it's a known task, right? Because when, and I think maybe growth gets sort of like, well, I want to be in the growth company, but like growth, when you're in a growth CEO, and this is where that wartime thing comes together, right? It's like something has gone wrong, right? Things are no longer, we are not on solid footing. Either our business model is not sound, our strategy is not good, or both. And therefore, you know, we're going to sort of, if you will, suspend normal operating procedures that we've been following, because we have some type of emergency. We have to do something. And I would say, like most of human beings, like most of our lives, like we would prefer to, like if you think about your own life, like you like to have a schedule of some reasonable set of expectations, a schedule, a known set of activities that you're going to do. Doesn't mean it's all easy, but you kind of know what it is versus, I almost think of like growth is like a snowstorm has hit your area. And it's like, well, we kind of have to suspend all of our daily routines and deal with this. But our goal in that snowstorm is to get through it and then to get back to our routine. So maybe growth implies like it's too positive. And I think in a startups is a good example, right? Every startup starts as a growth CEO because like you, by definition, you have no revenue, but we all know it's really maybe chaos, especially at a startup where it's just like, nobody has any idea. You're like, you're just trying to figure out, can we make any money at all? Is there any type of strategy that will work? And if it doesn't work, you know, the growth CEO quickly becomes everyone is leaving. That company's getting shut down. So I don't look at it so much as like, you know, you don't want to be in the growth mindset, at least this way I'm phrasing it all the time. It's almost like a heightened state of anxiety that will wear you out.
I think yeah. And to take one more pass at this phrasing, and then maybe we'll get into the actual substance of what you're saying instead of just the words. But maybe we can draw on your extensive knowledge of sports lore to figure out phrases they would use there. Because the word that, as you were talking, one of the words that popped into my head instead of status quo was like winning. Because if you're operating this way, you're successful. That's the thing about business. If you're not successful, you're dead. So just by being alive, you're successful. And so like, but if you're operating the status quo, your business is just like the Google case, your business is fine. You're just making tons of money. You don't have to change anything. So you're just winning, right?
Yeah.
However, that's a little aggressive about winning, right? But I imagine in the sports land, you know, my limited knowledge of sports, you know, you go and interview the quarterback afterwards and they're just like, well, we just got on the field and played the game. And so like there must be a name for like that kind of like just do the training, like do the stuff.
Well, one thing in sports leagues, because I did think a little bit about that is, and you know, this applies to all sports leagues. So here in the United States, you know, the American football season is almost over. And so what happens at the end of every American football season, they have something called Black Monday. And it's very simple. And it's sort of like the teams that did very, very poorly, they all fire their coach. And right. So they're basically going to have to rebuild their teams or rebuild the program. So that would be almost like there's now a growth mindset just because most everyone involved in the team will be fired. And then the second set of teams are the teams that like they did okay, maybe even a little above average, but they didn't make, you know, they didn't win the championship. So most of the time there, it's not that the coach generally doesn't get fired. But what happens is they shuffle some of the assistants, they trade some of the players, they get in some new players, right? So they're sort of just, if you will, optimizing their current strategy. It's like there isn't a full tilt change. And then, of course, finally, the championship winners, right? They go on. And for the most part, they don't necessarily change anything, but change is imposed upon them because their best players leave or the coaches assistants on those teams get hired to go run the bad teams, right? So it's sort of like this cycle. And I think that's maybe a good way to think of it is sort of like, you know, I guess instead of calling it the growth CEO, if we just called you like, you know, you're sort of like, you're like the new coach hired to fix all the problems. It's probably not as glamorous as it is to kind of take over a winning team. And you can kind of apply this maybe to Google, right? Sundar, right? It's sort of like he took over Google when it's still great. So don't get me wrong. It's just like, but he took it over maybe at the height was like, yeah, everything's great. But then a lot of people have left Google for other jobs, right? And maybe that's one of the reasons, you know, success and growth has slowed down there as a sports analogy.
Yeah. 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 You know, it's almost your Black Monday thing's almost like, I always get this wrong, but it's like the three envelopes and a desk thing when the new CEO or president comes and you know, his predecessor says, I've left you some advice in these three envelopes and only open them when you need to. And so something goes wrong and he opens the first envelope open the first envelope. And it says, blame your staff if something goes wrong in the business. Right. And so he blames the staff and he gets new assistant coaches or new, you know, VPs. And then the business is going terribly. And then it says, like I said, I always get this wrong. He opens the envelope and he says, apologize and, you know, try to do something new, take responsibility. And then he does that and it doesn't work out. And then something goes terrible and he opens the third envelope and it says, get out a piece of paper and three envelopes and write the letters.
That's right. And yeah, that's pretty much true. I like that. It's a good analogy.
I'll have to look. I messed the middle part up. I'll have to figure that one out. But and then, you know, so getting to it, it is, you know, in true me fashion, I didn't actually go read up on the IBM story, but apparently they're doing great. And which is just sort of like, okay, right? Like here we had however many consecutive years, we could say quarters, but I think quarters turn into years eventually of just like, people think IBM's terrible. And all of a sudden, I think even the register's like, oh, they really turned it around at IBM because of AI. And you're like, huh? Like, maybe it gets back to your circumstance thing is like, and I've always wondered this, and again, I had not investigated about IBM's AI stuff is like, so last year when AI was becoming big, I was thinking like, boy, I think IBM probably has a lot to say here. Like, maybe it didn't work out well. It was who knows? Like, they had tech, I don't know. I'm not going to say anything because I don't actually know the truth, but like they probably have like, you know, a lot of like field material and sales plays around enterprise AI that they could probably go dust off and just use. Like here's the qualification questions you ask to see if people should use enterprise AI. And I feel like hopefully those marketing and field marketing people haven't left because they could probably just use them like ongoing. So that's a circumstantial thing where like, I'm guessing IBM didn't have a lot to do, maybe research-wise, but not business-wise in like the whole past year of AI phenomena. And all of a sudden, apparently they're doing awesome.
I think, you know, to dive in that one, I think what the market is saying there is like IBM, you know, maybe to their detriment, maybe it was great, you know, planning aside for yourself. It's like they've been promoting Watson for like forever, right? Which is sort of broadly associated with AI. If you go back and even some of the commercials, right? Like I think they had Bob Dylan on there, like Watson's going to do it. And then they mostly retired that, right? Until this latest version of AI has come out and they kind of rebranded it. I think it's Watson X with a lowercase W, which is, you know, just sort of like the trademark IBM ad campaign. So I think the broad investor market's like, oh, well, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, or like at least like some kind of marketing or kind of, if you will, belief that you've been doing. And I think what investors are like, well, now's the time for you to shine because you've been talking about this even when it was out of favor. Now, I think the question for IBM, like always, is like, okay, when you get beyond that ad campaign and you're like, you go down and try to do something, like, is there actually something there that's meaningful? Like, to my knowledge, right, there's no like Watson ChatGPT. Like there isn't stuff that you can touch and do. Well, this is where Microsoft, Alphabet, you know, Anthropic, ChatGPT, all those things are like very, very tangible. And I think that's the question for them going forward. Well, is this sort of like, if you will, like a false indicator? It's like, well, you talked a lot about this, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have something. So that'll be fun for us to track with IBM over the next few years.
So to pull it at your distinction here, some more to learn. I think we have a good idea of the status quo or the winning thing. Like you've got an established business, you just got to run it. And of course, like just like you just run the ball or whatever. I don't know. Is that running the ball is when you That's don't fine. Throw
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
right?
That works. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right. Do they call it throwing the ball when you're not running the ball?
Passing, right? You pass.
Oh, passing.
Do you have a strong run game or a strong pass game? That you know. But whatever works, we'll accept either.
That's interesting. I guess it's passing because you're giving it to someone else versus throwing. You would throw and bat. Well, you pass it in basketball, but throwing implies no one is catching it. It's just going to the end. So passing, I guess, is more. I'll put that in my.
Put that in your sports analogy.
It's my commonplace notebook. Huh? what was I talking about? Oh, yes. So I think we kind of know what the status quo is now. Now growth. That seems to imply, in the tech world, some sort of, I think chaos is right for the beginning, but for a large established company, tell me if this is wrong or is not exactly what you're thinking, but it implies innovation. Maybe not only product innovation, it could also be business innovation, or it could be maybe even like go-to-market and sales innovation. I guess you could have pricing innovation. Like, you know, you can innovate. It's almost like once you mess with pricing and the way that you sell your product, that's almost like the business equivalent of financial engineering, where you're not actually doing anything. You're just kind of messing around with SKUs and prices and stuff, but whatever. But I, is that kind of like what we're focused on in a growth area, is innovating of some sort?
Yeah, no, I think that's, well, I think it's, it, by definition, it's sort of like something that you have not done, either because the technology didn't exist, you didn't have the product, or to your other point, like organizationally, you had decided not to pursue that. And I think, so some examples that I kind of think of already is like, so we talked about Microsoft and sort of their investment in, you know, ChatGPT and OpenAI, right? That's something that maybe they wouldn't have done 10 or 15 years ago, right? But they really see a weakness in their portfolio, so they reacted to it. I think maybe on a new market example would be NVIDIA, right? They sort of were, you know, kind of, you know, building graphics cards, right? And then that kind of fell into like, well, this Bitcoin mining thing is good. But much more importantly, then this idea of OpenAI came out. And so there's a combination of luck and strategy there. Like they built, if you will, a way to do all of this vector math really efficiently without really knowing AI was coming. At least, I don't know. You can debate that. Maybe Jensen Huang would be like, no, no, I, this is exactly what I saw. But more importantly is like that market exploded out of nowhere, right? At least I, in all, for all intents and purposes for them, it did, right? And they went from being like a very successful, like company worth hundreds of millions to a company that's like, I don't know, almost like a trillion, if not more, right? And that was sort of like them, if you will, you know, again, like how do you tell the story? Did it just sort of happen and they kind of fell into it? Or did they have great strategic thinking? And as soon as the market kind of shifted towards AI and needing GPUs, did they, you know, quickly adjust their sales force and quickly start selling? And the answer is probably like both, right? To all these things. So that's just another example of a market. And then, you know, today, you know, we're, you know, probably not, neither one of us bought the Apple Vision Pro, and there's like a million, you know, reviews of it today. I recommend, you know, go read The Verge or Ben Thompson or whatever, because they all have different takes. But that's a good one for Apple. It's like, okay, Apple is sort of, you know, massively successful, maybe the most successful company in the world, depending on how you want to value that. But, you know, they need growth, right? And that's what people are excited about. That's why Tim Cook's like, okay, we're going to put forward a new platform. Vision Pro is a completely new platform. It's being compared to all of the previous platforms. And the belief is that it will somehow spawn a business similar, you know, to the iPhone, or maybe similar to the iPad. And, you know, we're going to see. We're going to see what happens there. And so, you know, they're starting to do, I don't know, I would say in their case, it's like it is a new product, and they're trying to see. It's almost like a new product that they think will invent a new market. To contrast that with NVIDIA, that's sort of like, oh, we have a product, and we just need to apply it to this new market that's obvious, right? Will there be a Vision Pro market? Like, that's why, like, there's 1,000 people writing, you know, hot takes about, like, Vision Pro is going to be the next big thing. And other people are saying it's like, ah, it's a great piece of technology that won't lead to anything new. And, like, time will tell what happens there.
Yeah, I think those are, you've mentioned two, I guess, I don't know if it's a natural experiment. That probably means something like important to academics. Maybe our professor friend can tell us, but like you've got Microsoft, which I'm trying to think if this is true, but I feel like for the most part, and hopefully no one takes this as insulting, but Microsoft's success has largely been about adapting to what's going on in the world. Kind of like your NVIDIA case. Like, of course, there's lots of things where they set out and they're like, we're going to innovate this new thing and do this new thing. But like, for example, they didn't invent GitHub, right? they bought that. And like, I'm not really sure if there are, well, not the fact that I don't know, because what the fuck do I know? But like, there's not a lot of things that you would be like, oh, Microsoft innovated that. It didn't exist beforehand. And it's a brand new thing in the past 10 years. Like, and I don't know, they've kind of sort of always been like this. They've just been good. They've just been some of the best people at doing already existing ideas and figuring out the business around it and just kind of ongoing doing something with it, which is fine. Like, that's a good type of innovation. And then also, the other thing that's notable about them for this ongoing observing them for your dichotomy here is that they're more or less like business focused. Right. I know they have Xbox and whatever, but like probably most of their revenue comes from business and not from individuals, except however many millions of dollars they make, or billions of dollars they make off of Minecraft, I guess, but whatever. That's their hedge. They can always, if Azure goes poorly, they're just all in on Minecraft. they're gonna pull a Lego on Minecraft and it's just gonna go nuts. And so whereas Apple, almost exclusively to the point that they're a pure consumer company. And you know, you can say that they didn't invent the cell phone or the smartphone or whatever, but like they more or less evolved it. I mean, that's almost like saying that like
right, they perfected it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's just like if you were flying in some like intercontinental jet today and be like, yeah, I mean, they just copied the Wright brothers. It's like, sure. So Apple, since the return of Steve Jobs or whatever, like they do invent new things or like the best version of an existing category that's like so far and away better that it's just like you don't even whatever, it's just so much better, right? And so with them, yeah, you're right, they are kind of at this area where the problem with that kind of business is it's a hit making business and you need new hits for the investors, right? You can't just be like, we make tons of money. Like I think they make like, aren't they worth like $1 trillion now or something? I don't know what their revenue is.
At this point. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I mean, those Wall Street analysts could be upset and you know, I'm sure the Apple execs are like, pick up your phone and tell me what it is. Right. And they all probably have Apple phones. But the point being that like, yes, now they need to come up with a new thing, which is just like, I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. It's super scary for them then if this is the best they've got, these goggle things. Right now, on the other hand, as all the Apple apologists are saying, like the first few years of the iPhone were not impressive at all, right? Like they weren't, like in retrospect they were kind of ridiculous, but yeah, I think those are two ongoing things to look at, like how these two companies
and the Apple boardroom, right? The ongoing conversation is something like, well, we have this Apple Vision Pro, which is the goggles, and we're going to see how, and that's actually out, so we're going to be able to touch it. But the other long running project, right, that the only way you really hear about it is when people leave the project for the most part, or maybe occasionally, is the car, right? They're going to build a self-driving car, and this has been probably in development for like, you know, I don't know, 10 plus years. And they just announced the other day that one of the heads of that project has left for Rivian, right? And so, you know, that's the kind of the question is like, well, can Apple, because obviously they could build a car. I mean, and it could, you know, we can all envision it being massively successful, but it sounds like so far, you know, they haven't been able to build anything that they're happy with, right, to bring to market. And I think that's like, and I think this whole thing with the Apple Vision Pro, like, and I think Tim Cook is sort of, you know, it's like what I would like to call him, almost like he's like the Hall of Fame, you know, I'm going to call it the status quo or the strategy, you know, CEO, right? It's sort of like he took over and it was like, hey, I just want you to run this business as well as you can and make as much money. And he has done that absolutely perfectly, like better than anyone probably could have ever done, maybe even better than Steve Jobs could have done over this time period, right? And so as he sort of maybe thinks about leaving the company, you know, is Apple Vision Pro going to be sort of like his crowning achievement where he sort of sets up the next massive growth problem, platform for the company, and he'll maybe retire in a few years and be like, it's in good hands, good luck, you know, run the strategy? Or will it not go well, right? And Apple's under attack for all these other reasons that we won't go into today, right? About, you know, the EU and the App Store and all that kind of stuff. Will he go out and sort of like, no, you know, that business, his services business is being kind of eroded. The Apple Vision Pro isn't a big hit. And then maybe there'll be the appetite for the growth person. It's like, hey, we got to come in and we got to look at everything. We can't just be doing the way things Steve Jobs did it. We got to look at whatever the next disruptive strategy will be. So that's why I think it's really interesting. Apple's at a really interesting point. And the whole Apple Vision Pro, it's like, you know, my take is like, until I use it, like I'm going to prevent having any opinion, right? Because it just seems like impossible. So that's why it's fun for us to kind of watch.
Yeah, yeah. Is that, you have to go into the selling sugar water business or something.
That's right.
And see what's up with that. Well, speaking of innovation, I don't know if I'll get to experience this this year, but it looks like finally every American's hopes and dreams and those who do business in the U.S. have finally come true. It looks like the IRS has acquired, you know, Intuit, and so that you can pay your taxes, which is great. TurboTax. Now I joke, but I think from reading it, you probably know better than I do. But like, it looks like the IRS has basically made a version of TurboTax so that you, it'll help you fill out your taxes online, which is sounds good to me. Like, you know, for one thing, it's probably, you probably know it's going to be done correctly. And if not, it's not your fault because you use their software. Like, I think that's, that should be a bit of a relief. Obviously, if you put fraudulent information in, that would be bad, but it seems like, you know, your, whatever bugs may occur, you may profit. Or actually, in several countries over here, the government software was screwed up and people got really fucked over. But you know, they find out about it.
I think this is such a, because, you know, you kind of mentioned this, I think, last week or maybe in a previous episode, is that, you know, the government, if you will, digital transformation inside the government has the potential to, if you will, save people more time than maybe any other company that I can think of, if you just think about it. Because we've been talking a lot about global entry and the improvements there. I think last week I talked about, like, this jury system was really good. And then we can go on and on about some success files, but, like, success stories, rather. But really, if you come down to it, like, I think automating the process upon which many millions of Americans file their taxes, like, I don't know exactly what the saving time savings would be, but it's, you know, it's, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of man hours, right? So that's why I think this is such a good example of it. Now, the program is called Direct File for Internal Revenue Service. And so for those outside the United States, you'll probably find it crazy. It's like, you know, here in the United States, like, you have to download what is like a paper form. Like, if you were to do it the most standard way, you would download a paper form. You have to collect all your information, and then you kind of go through and you almost do like a little worksheet that you would do like in maybe like middle school or something, right? Like, you know, okay, you know, do this, subtract this, add this, right? And it comes up with some numbers. You have to then send all that in. Now, a lot of that's automated through at least online services, right? Like, you're talking about TurboTax. But around the world, I think Matt Raber here, I think in Australia being one, like, you just get a bill. I don't know. Is this the truth in the Netherlands where they just tell you what you owe, or do you have to, like, do some paperwork?
You know, this is where I'm like privileged guy. I don't know.
You just have,
I have accounts.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Well, that's the way that we, you know, a lot of people end up doing it, right? You just end up with accounts. So, but all this is to say, it's like the government in this case, such a good example. In for most returns in the United States, the government actually has all the information. They actually have it all, right? And in fact, like, it's almost like we have all the information, but we want to see if you have the information, if you put it in right. And if you don't put it in right, we're going to send you a nasty gram and says you didn't do it right, and yeah, we're going to penalize you. So, but anyone that's like seeing this from the outside would be like, well, you have all the information, and like, you know, if that person owes money or you should send them money, so you should just do that, right? And so, of course, like, from the outside, you're like, well, just do that. Like, you have a big computer system, just do that. So, but where we are here is that the lobbying against this is so fierce from TurboTax and various, you know, parties that are incentivized to keep, if you will, let's just say accounting in general. They want, and I get it. Like, again, if we just go back to incentives, if someone came to you and says, like, I'm going to destroy your job and take it away, I would not be happy about it. I'd be like, wait a minute, I have some questions. I would like, but from a society point of view, we can look at this and be like, we don't need to do it this way. So the fact that the government, after all this time, they're just now at a pilot project, because it's not I don't think it's a technology question. They're just trying to automate the simplest returns. Right. But the fierce lobbying that's going to go on against this is like, oh no, the government's going to, like, you can just imagine all the slogans. They're going to do it wrong. They're going to take your money. They don't want you to know what's going on. Right. And it's like, no. And it, like, to me, it's just so obvious. It's like, you can still do it the old way. Don't worry. If you want to, you can, or you can just like accept this automated return and do it. And it's like to me, it's like the good here, the potential to save, I'm going to say millions of man hours is so high. Right? Mm-hmm. Or person hours, millions of person hours, shall I say, is so high. We should definitely do this. But because it's such a good idea in my mind, I know it could potentially never happen in my lifetime, right? That the TurboTax people are going to fight it to the end, right? They're going to be like, you can't do it. And so I was even thinking to myself, you were kind of joking about it. It's like, maybe the government should just be like, we're like almost like a private equity firm. It's like, we're going to buy you, right? Rather than fight you, we're going to actually literally buy your company. You're going to, and like the earn out would be like, when we're automating like all of the simple returns in the United States, we're then going to give you a huge bonus, right? Because I know that seems crazy, but it's like, instead of fighting you, I want to just pay you out. I just want to pay you out so you'll let it happen. And so it's almost, now I know that can never happen as well, but like that would almost be the more honest way. It's like, I know you don't want to lose your jobs. I don't want you to fight me. And I'm just going to give you lots of money to make the problem go away. So hopefully it'll happen.
I love that. That's like a pre-Trump libertarian reverse privatization scheme. Right. Where like we've got this person, we've got this company in private industry that does this solution well. So let's just buy them and make them part of the government. And
right, I almost think it's like eminent domain for digital transformation, right? Where it's just like where it's just like, yep, you have a really nice farm and we're going to build a road right through it. And then they're like, no, you're not. And you know what you do? You just sit down and you're like, you know what? We're going to give you a lot of money. And then they're like, that's not enough. You know what we're going to do? We're going to give you even more money. And then finally you get to a number. It's like, you know what? I don't need the farm. You know, it's like, that's really what it comes down to. And I think that's what we got to do with Intuit. Be like, how much money are you going to take for us to just like get this tax problem? Like, we just want to automate it for everyone. Like, what's it going to cost us? Because you know, numbers are so enormous when you think about the U.S. taxes, right? Like, I mean, like almost no number is unreasonable when you start to like get down to this. You're like, I mean, it's like trillions on trillions on trillions, right? And so that's what I want them to do. I want them to be like, TurboTax, you can't fight us on this. How much is it going to cost?
It would be great. They could take a page from Apple and just give Intuit 50 cents for every tax return. And I think it would be perfect.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it is. It's almost like a royalty on tax returns to let it happen. That, oh my gosh, that would be so fantastic. That'd be so funny.
Yeah. Now, in reading this, are they pre-populating the fields for you?
They are. They are absolutely for like that, only pilot. It's only
that is amazing. Program.
And for those that are follow the taxes, it's only what they call like the simplest tax forms, which is honestly is most the tax
1040 forms. 1040 easy or something.
Yeah, it's basically if you only got if you only had a traditional job, got W-2 income, and you fall into this thing. Because again, like it's a pilot program, so they sort of have to carve it off. And you know, Intuit and TurboTax, they've had this for a long time. It's like if you quote unquote only need the simple return, they'll let you do that for free. So that's sort of their freemium, right? It's like, oh, well, because you're only entering in like two or three numbers. And they're like, sure, we'll do it for free. And that's their way of saying like, government, stay out of this. Like, you see, we're going to do it for free. And it's like, no, I'm the opposite. Like, keep going, automate everything, right? Because like, I think we got to get to where, you know, as you get older over time, you just sort of like, you know, even if you're like, not super wealthy, but you're like have a couple different, you know, if you will, assets, you end up what you were saying before, Cote, you end up with an accountant. It's like, no, we actually, most of us don't need all that. Like it's not that complicated. So, so they're doing it, but it's, again, it's carved out in a very simple area. And why I can go on, but I want them to keep going. I want them to go further.
Oh, yeah.
I want this to become the defining example of the greatest digital transformation project ever built. I think it's like, if you could automate tax returns, I'm going to say, I'm putting that on record as like, I think that would be the number one digital transformation project of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, they still don't have Mastodon integration with Threads. So I think doing like little bits at a time, you don't want to overpromise.
That's what
you're doing there. Yeah. Well, I wanted to mention before we get to the end part of the show, I think I wanted to mention just one little thing. Maybe I'll do some more thinking and talking about this at some point. But that over in the Slack channel, some people were talking about a recent study by the I forget the full name of the company, DX or something. I've actually like that. This reminds me, I was actually interviewed by, you know, their guy, the face of the DX company, on a podcast, and I don't think they ever published that. So I must have really fucked it up or something. There's a paper in the is it the American Computer, what's ACM, computer,
I don't know, I have to look it up,
mumbo people, whatever, ACM machines, the Association of Computational Machines,
yeah, computing machinery, go on.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Anyways, so there's a new paper in there that I think I forget the guy's name, but kind of co-written by a bunch of DX people, and it made me think that maybe this is a business idea. As always, we have a lot of them. That's why we're such a, that's why we can hire accountants to do our taxes. We have so much profit in our winning model of operation. I think we need to start an award, an annual award. Well, it won't be annual. It'll be like the Nobel Prizes aren't like this, but there's some sort of Medal of Achievement thing where like you only grant the award when it needs to be granted. You don't just gratuitously do it. And I think it would be this, and I'm going to call it the tech marketing guerrilla champ or something, you know, guerrilla right. marketing. And I think we're going to have to retcon in a history for it when we launch it. I think the previous winners will be people like Google and Red Hat for Kubernetes, mm-hmm. Puppet and Chef for infrastructure as code and DevOps. People who have basically, they've done marketing that seems like, and it is just sort of like general industry commentary, but it turns out that if that category and those ideas are successful, they will be wildly successful as well, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of like, yeah, infrastructure as code, great idea. And then, you know, the Puppet and Chef people are like, oh, and by the way, could we have a meeting about that? You're now qualified, right?
Right. You know, it's like thought leadership that led to something, right? It's like actually realized something. I like it.
And you know, hence the DevOps report and all of that that kind of stuff. And I think this year, we'll see what happens, but we might have to give out an award because this DX company, they're getting really close. Mm-hmm. They've been showing up with developer productivity a lot, talking about it, and they just happen to have a product that really helps you figure out what your developer productivity is and report on. And again, which is totally cool, but I really, and I mean this genuinely and also shittily, but mostly genuinely, I admire that kind of marketing and good job for them. I think the previous award winner, maybe it was last year, goes to Humanitech for platform engineering.
Okay.
And also I figured out that what we need to do is we're going to give, also as needed, we'll give lifetime achievement awards. And I was thinking about, we're going to call it the Martin Fowler, lifetime achievement award. And I'm going to work with him to give it out. And I think, of course, Nicole Ferguson, I think, I'm going to retroactively achieve her a lifetime, achievement award here. And of course, Kelsey Hightower. But if anyone has suggestions, for the award nominees, maybe we'll go over this at the end.
Yeah, I like it. No, that's a good idea. Like who, send some people. And maybe we need to have, Nicole. I don't know her, but maybe you do. Could. Maybe we need to have her on and like, she could tell us about the greatness of this report. So I like it. Good ideas.
Yeah. But I think that's, you know, and for the marketing people out there, I think you can learn a lot from that kind of marketing. Like we talked, it might have even been last episode, but we talked a lot about developer advocacy and relations. And this type of marketing is a huge amount of what you're doing in developer relations. And I think it's very hard for developer relations people to do it because if you know what you're doing, it can feel really icky. And you start thinking of it in terms of propaganda and almost like cultural imperialism and you know, you bring in all that kind of stuff, which yeah.
Yeah, but I like what you have here is like really good examples of success. Sometimes we don't like they're not always clear to people, but I think you said infrastructure as code, that's one maybe we're closest to. And sort of like, yeah, that kind of started off sort of just as this kind of undefined idea that sort of like made sense. And then, you know, the people behind that you kind of named sort of grew it into like a very tangible thing. And now it's like second nature. So when it works, right, when you're sort of like infrastructure code, when it becomes part of the industry vernacular, you know, you've exceeded, if you will, in developer and relations or, you know, kind of thought leadership in a way very few people do. But like, but when you kind of start out, like it probably seems like the first time someone writes it up, there's going to be a lot of like shoulder shrugs, like, this is just another blah, blah, blah. Right. But like when you do it right, it can actually achieve to some massive success. So I like that.
Yeah. 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 If you see, you know, Configuration Management Camp is coming up. I'll cover that in the conferences. But if you see Adam Jacobs talk from last year's Configuration Management Camp, you can see the launching of one of these kind of, maybe guerrilla is the wrong word, because back to your thing, that implies warfare, basically. Or maybe it's patterned after the great ape, and it's a compliment, but I don't think so. But, you know, we could call it developer advocacy marketing. That sounds good.
I like that. Yeah. That's a good idea. It's good stuff there.
So speaking of that, do we have any bureaucracy this episode?
We do. So, you know, an idea of, if you will, let's give everyone equal time. On the podcast, as Michael points out, we often, because we are basically three Americans, there's often a lot of takes about like what it's like in Europe from an American perspective, or in case of Matt Ray, what it's like in Australia from an American perspective. But Michael turned the tables this week. He is a European that came to the U.S. And he said, hey, he wanted to point out some stuff that he noticed here that he thought was weird. So I'll read through it real quick because I thought it was pretty, some of it was funny and, you know, funny in a way that feels true. So one was, he said, on the bad side, things he thought were bad about America was like, just too much waste. When you order food in the United States, everything is in like packed in like three different forms of packing, and like eating for a family of four, just sort of like you end up with like a whole pile of trash. Agreed. I don't know why we do that, but that is actually true. He said he went to the Hilton Garden Buffet. I think he was traveling with his family. And there was no vegetable or fruit at the Hilton Garden Buffet. Oh. I can for sure confirm there's no vegetables. There's usually a stray banana somewhere in the Hilton Garden Buffet, but yeah. You're right. It's mostly stuff out of packets. So that was true. He went to Cane's Chicken, which I've not had. I know some people love it. Yeah, I'm just going to say he did not like the Cane's Chicken. It was just disgusting in his assessment. And he even said that he wanted to get some fast food. And then he finally said, maybe Kote, this is like home to you. He's like, there's a lot of bread in the United States, there is no good bread in the United States. Oh. Which I was like, well, it's probably true. Like, there's no like bakery on the corner where you get it. So those are all the bad things. I think they're all I think they're pretty much true. And on the good side, he said, everyone, I never think of this, but he said everyone in the United States is like super nice, including the TSA agents they interacted with. So that's good. He said the food is always served very quickly. And the museum and galleries were great. He went to a bunch of them. And then finally, you know, as Kote, you pointed out many times, he also likes the fact that we have free water almost anywhere. So I appreciate Michael sending in his review. I think those were all good comments about a European, if you will, visiting in the United States. And if you're a European, or really if you're anywhere, and when you travel, you want to help spread the word of Software Defined Talk, what you should do is send me your postal address to stickers@softwaredefinedtalk.com. And I will be happy to send you a sticker anywhere in the world. Maybe you can put it on your Tumblr as you go through TSA and they'll be like, hey, that's a great podcast. Welcome to the United States. I don't know. Maybe that'll happen. Probably not. But, you know, you do you, if you will.
You know, so when I was thinking through his list there, one of my first reactions it made me think of a principle, maybe. I don't know. Just some thinking with a twist. And so what, you know, he did point out that if you want good food, you have to go to a nicer restaurant, right? Like a lot of the stuff he was talking about was fast food. And so the first reaction to that would be like, well, you ate at the fast food places. But I think this is the twist, is I think, no, that doesn't negate it at all. Because like, if you go to like Rome or Paris or London, definitely Amsterdam, and you hang out in the tourist areas, the food there is also crap, right? Like it has a lot to do with the tourist stuff. And now you could say, well, don't eat in the inner rings of Amsterdam unless you really know where you're going. Because it's just there's a bunch of Argentinian steakhouses and I don't know what the fuck that is, right? Like, it's just like, there's a bunch of bad food. However, I think that the tourism boards of these cities, instead of saying like, well, you got to eat at good places, they need to realize that you are going to be rated as a city based on your worst food. Right? Like, no one's going to take the time to find the good food. So that means that like, as a culture, you've got to focus on making the fast food, the so-called worst food, like really good. Otherwise, you're just going to lose the food thing. Right? And so like, I think that is the appropriate way to rate kind of the cuisine culture of a country, is to say like, so what's their worst food like? And if their worst food is pretty good, just imagine how good the good food is.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. And to be fair, too, like I summarized a lot of this feedback. If you want to get into a lot of discussion, especially about Cane's Chicken, there's a lot of opinions about Cane's Chicken. You should go to the Software Defined Talk Slack. This spawned off quite a thread about, you know, food and Cane's Chicken and, you know, just the general dietary ideas around the world. So there's a lot of good stuff. If you're interested in being part of that conversation, get in there. Get into the Slack. Yeah.
I think it was an incredibly accurate analysis, and I look forward to more analyses from other people. And as if there's any more commentary that Michael there has, and he did. It does look like since he was in New York and DC, he probably saw, if not the best, some of the best museums that the states have to offer. So that's very, very lucky of them. So speaking of the very best. I don't know. There's several conferences coming up. As I mentioned earlier, Configuration Management Camp is actually next week, February 5th and 6th, if I remember. Now, I know that everyone knows that Configuration Management Camp is renowned for being the conference that you go to after my wife's birthday on February 4th. But I, you know, aside from that, it actually is a, it's a wonderful conference. I'm lucky that I've been able to go many times. And I think this will be the second time that I'm speaking on the second day. It really is like, it's kind of, for its area, it's the equivalent of the Monktoberfest conference, right? Monktoberfest is a very insidery kind of industry conference. And Configuration Management Camp, like all of, even though it's in Ghent, is actually a great town, but like it's not really on the international tech conference scene. Despite being in a place that's kind of hard to get to, you can't fly to Ghent, more or less, but like it has, it's got pretty much all the big stars of the infrastructure software cloud, community. Most all of them show up there over the years. That's my review of Configuration Management Camp. You should go to it, next week. It's pretty fantastic. There's also the UK's, Open Technology Conference. They're having an open source conference and hardware on February 6th to 7th. That's also next week. So you can check that out if you can fit that into your schedule there. And there's also Scale and DevOps Days LA, March 14th to 17th. I'll be speaking there at DevOps Days LA with the opening talk. I should just call it a keynote because that sounds pretty awesome. I'm going to be giving the keynote.
Why not, baby? Why not?
And then there's also KubeCon EU Paris coming up March 19th and 22nd. I don't think my waitlist talk is going to be moved up. Because apparently it's at one of the side conferences, the side loaded conferences, but whatever. I'll be there nonetheless. Thanks to them for giving me a media pass here for Software Defined Talk. So I'll be watching other people ask the medium questions during the press conference and see what the responses are. Then there's DevOps Days Birmingham, April 17th to 18th, which I'm sure will be good. And then finally, I want to put a special invitation out to the self-identifying executives out there in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I found out yesterday, a couple of days ago, and it's actually nice. I'm going to be going there March 31st to host an executive dinner about, I don't know, Java and Spring and security and things like that. It'd be interesting to see what kind of executives show up to talk about Spring and Java security, but whatever. And there's a link in the show notes if you want to go kind of like apply to go to it. And look, if you've listened this far to this podcast, I'll be frank with you. I don't get to decide who's to go. There's probably only like 12 to 15 slots that'll open up. But if you're actually an executive at a Fortune 500-ish type of account and you have some sort of budgetary authority over whatever it is we sell at Tanzu, chances are high you'll qualify and they'll have you come to this dinner. We've got a security speaker from Honeywell of all places as well. And, you know, you'll get a free dinner and, you know, you can make some inside jokes about the podcast to me, which I would really, really appreciate. That would be great. But go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/452. You can get links to all those conferences. I don't have a discount code for KubeCon, but I think I might be able to scrounge one up for next episode. And see if you want to come get a free dinner if you're some sort of fancy pants executive. Why not? So speaking of fancy pants executives, I think, Brandon, you finally uncovered the best, probably always going to be best case study of the mystery of the rise of the Stanley Cup.
That's true, Cote. You're on to me. I have, of course, been talking. I'm sort of obsessed with this. It's like I wanted this to be a Harvard business case study. And I think we found it. So basically, there's a podcast, and it's done by, what's it? It's Derek, I can't remember his last name, but it's called Plain English. It's one of the Spotify Ringer podcasts. But they did a deep dive on specifically why the Stanley Cups are more than just water bottle, and why they are so successful. And they did the thing that I like, where they sort of kind of take the original story and they kind of delve into it. And the author, or in this case, the podcast host, has a lot of experience in studying like hit music, like how hits are made and like tastemakers and stuff like that. So he applies a lot of that knowledge and that kind of information to like looking or analyzing why Stanley's went so, so successful. And I liked it too, because in the end, it's sort of like, there are some things that they did well, but then there's a lot of luck and they talk a lot about that as well. And I think it's just like a really good example of it. So it's like for all the people like at Yeti who are being beat over the head, like, why aren't you like Stanley? It's like, well, because it's complicated and a lot of this is luck. Even if you do stuff that works out. And I just think like more of those stories need to be told. But I don't know, Coach, it looks like you actually listened to this one. It looks like you had some thoughts. What were your thoughts about the podcast?
Well, I think, you know, I could I don't know, any topic I could probably talk for 90 minutes. But like I could go on about this. I think what I'll do is I'll try to take my commentary here and do a more, I don't like to promise these kinds of things, but do a larger write-up in my newsletter, which you could subscribe to if you go to newsletter.cote.io. Again, if you've listened this far, you should probably be subscribing to that newsletter at newsletter.cote.io. But in summary, it's definitely worth an episode. I'm not always a fan of these kind of like NPR show masquerading as a podcast situation, but that battle has been lost probably 20 years ago. So I should just give it the fuck up. But I think it's a great study if in our space, in the tech space, because it really does get to, I think if you have your mindset to it, building out a lot of what we were talking about at the beginning, you can see the same structure playing out in the tech world. And that structure is, as we talked about earlier, and as Brandon just said, that a lot of business success is just like, and just is the wrong word because it's kind of demoting it. A lot of business success depends on you being ready for a good opportunity to open up for you. You could call that luck, but it's really, I think, setting up your organization and the culture to always be scanning for and trying to experiment with leveraging, taking advantage of just like circumstances and situations, right? And I think this happens in the tech industry a lot, right? Like, I mean, as I was kind of saying, I think that's a lot of Microsoft's success is they're just like, we should do something here, right? Not that we should invent this new category or do this new thing, but like, let's just go in there and do the shit out of it, right? And just have a run at it and see if this whole version control thing is a good idea or not. Like, and try that out. So I think when you listen to the kind of the second half of it, even the first half is a little sort of like, there's nothing magic. Well, is whatever. When you listen to the second half, you realize that, and they never really, this is my only complaint with the episode is they don't really, I guess they don't actually interview Stanley people. And they don't even say that they tried now that I'm thinking about it. But like, you would to really close out the case, you would want to talk with some people at Stanley and they would be like, yeah, I got this email one day about Mormon women. And I thought, what the fuck? Let's do it.
Let's go for it.
And right? Anyhow, I think it's a good case study. And just one more thing, I guess I'm writing my newsletter here anyways, but like, it was also making me think, like, since I've been in marketing so long, that it does point out a problem with marketing budgets, which is in marketing, you're always, I'll let listeners remember the old quip, the joke that is basically about this in advertising. But like in marketing, you're always worried about spending your dollars efficiently. Like, did we waste our money on this campaign or waste our money on that? And if you listen to this Stanley case study, what you realize is that it's a totally fucked up way to think about marketing. Because what you have to do is, like, let's say you have 20 marketing campaigns or strategies in a year, and only, let's see if I can do math this fast in my head, only two of them are like wildly successful. And so they have great ROI, right? And so that was a great way to spend your budget. And then if you look at the other 18 that failed and you're like, these have terrible ROI and we lost a ton of money. Like, that's a bad way to think about it because you had to try 20 things out in order to have any success. So all of those trying and experimenting things is like part of the ROI business case, which is going to bring down your ROI ratio a little bit, but it's also going to be more realistic, right? Like if you only tried two things, you have, let's see if I can do this math. You have a 10% chance of success, right? If only two things out of 20 are going to be successful and you're only allowed to pick two, and you have no idea which ones to pick, you're basically gambling. You have a 90% failure rate. Everyone who does that, did I do that math right? I was always confused about statistics. So you've got to think about every single experiment you have as part of that.
And maybe it's just to go back to our earlier discussion today, it's like, and I think that's sort of oftentimes the difference between the sustaining CEO, the strategy CEO, and the growth CEO. It's like, when are you willing to experiment, right? The growth CEO usually comes in with like, let's try a bunch of stuff. It's okay if it doesn't work. Whereas the strategy CEO is, and this is in large companies, they're going to be very, if you will, hamstrung, right? Everyone's going to be like, don't do that. That doesn't work. You know what I mean? It's like, only do the things that work. You're going to have a much different way to judge it. So you're right. I mean, but Cote, I think that's a great example of like, hey, you know, really, and really a lot of times people confuse marketing and ads, but that ship has sailed a long time. It's like, hey, just because you do a campaign, an advertising campaign, it doesn't work, it really isn't the end of the world, even though it's always perceived that way. So,
when you do it.
And when you do it in a growth mindset, people are like, that was a great experiment. When you do it in the strategy mindset, it's like, why did you waste all that money? You know, you should have gone to the show, right? You know, why did you waste money on the podcast ads? We should have done another roundtable dinner, right? Or vice versa. Like, you know, you said, oh, we got all this great thing because we did podcast ads, right? Which everyone should be doing, right? And it's, so it's just all about perspective, like we've been talking about.
And just to pile on so I don't have to write the newsletter, I'll write many other good things and I collect together links together, all sorts of good stuff and funny little quips and sayings if you go to newsletter.cote.io and subscribe. But the other thing, which I think is very instructive for thinking about the business of technology, not only the marketing, but the businesses. There's a great point in the podcast where there's a turn, and I forget her name, but she's kind of like the expert witness on the utility of the Stanley Cup for women, for American women. And she points out that like, yeah, it has a great shape. It's wide on top and narrow on the bottom, so you can put it in cup holders. And there's almost, and of course it's got multiple colors, but there's this magic feature. It has a handle. And there's big discussion of handles and how this is great and also how it's got the straw in there so that when you tip it over, the ice doesn't fall on your face. But it's almost like a very naive understanding of the success of the Stanley Cup would be like, and then they added a handle. But then the point of that, so you can think about this in a technology thing of like, well, this orchestrates your containers, right? And and the thing about the handle is like, I can add a fucking handle, right? Like, and in fact, all the competitors probably also had handles, right? And if they didn't have handles before that, they had handles like for as fast as those cargo ships could make it across the Pacific. Yep. And so like the point being that like the handle doesn't matter. There's something more than just like, you know, this one has YAML that's not as bad, right? Or like the actual functionality of it, which is anyways, great. The dog is very enthusiastic
about
it.
The dog loves the Stanley Cups, so I love it. That's a good endorsement.
Stick a Stanley Cup on her.
All right, okay, give us your recommendation. Get it over. Get yourself out of here.
Get over with.
So your poor dog doesn't attack you.
My recommendation is the, as everyone knows, I've been playing solo D&D, Dungeons & Dragons a lot. My kids were initially interested in it, but I really haven't figured out how to make them actually play. So that's fine. But I've been trying to use these systems for solo playing and they haven't worked out well, but I finally buckled down last week at some point and I was like, I'm actually going to, the most famous one is called the Mythic Game Master Emulator and they have edition 2 out and I tried doing it, but it just was like way too much to read and very confusing, but I was like, all right, I'm finally going to read it. So I took a lot of time to read it and study it and I've been using it and it's actually pretty great. It's if you actually just sort of like follow the rules and submit yourself to it instead of wanting to control and write the story on your own, which I think was my problem. It results in lots of great things. And I want to make a longer video of this, but because I want to experiment with it more, but I think if you pair this up with ChatGPT, you can finally get ChatGPT over its hump of creativeness. If you kind of like use ChatGPT to respond to some of the randomness that you get in the Mythic game thing, there's lots of other solo systems that are basically the same as this. But hopefully I'll do something on that. And I made a little video kind of explaining this. If you go to my YouTube channel, but you can also just go to softwaredefinedtalk.com. And get a softwaredefinedtalk.com/452 and see a link to that video. You should go to it. I'm slowly building my video empire. We'll see how it works out. Well, speaking of empires, I think we've been doing this podcast long enough and of high enough quality that we're in the winning stage of a revolution. And we thank everyone who's helping us win every day. We just, you know what we do. This is kind of the post podcast interview. We just put on the headphones, press record, and we just you know talk. We do a podcast. We just play the game, passing, running, no fumbles, whatever it may be. Sometimes you got to kick it, and you, that's it. Gatorade. We'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
All right, Kote, fantastic episode. What is the name of your dog? I feel like we should credit the dog with a podcast appearance. What's
Junebug. Her name Junebug. Is Junebug.
Well, Junebug, he or she? Is that a
she? Yeah.
She,
yeah.
I think she did well. I mean, at the end, though, she had stuff to say. We obviously shut her out. We didn't get enough airtime. So that was our fault. So.
I don't know. What is nothing to be done. Fun fact about Junebug. The letter J is extremely difficult for Dutch people to pronounce.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So it's not really like a sound that it's in the alphabet somewhere, I think, but it's not like a very common sound. So they'll want to say Junebug or like it's that hard J is, I wonder if it's like that in German too. But anyways.